Whoa. Whoa.
We're starting to sing a lot.
Whoa.
On the
so
road.
People are like, what's going on? So you guys, hello. We are in a restaurant, in a hotel in downtown Jackson, Mississippi. So what up? We's in the South. And it's Maria Hinojosa.
And it's Julio. And like you said, it's Wednesday morning in Jackson, Mississippi.
So what up, fam? What's going on? What up, Julio? What's going on?
I'm good. Just enjoying Jackson.
It's been great.
Yeah.
So we're recording this on Wednesday morning in Jackson, Mississippi, because we're here doing live shows and I'm here reporting for Latino USA. Deep, deep, beautiful, powerful, sad, amazing stories. You're about to listen to part two of our first live show that we did in Las Vegas, Nevada, which was amazing. So you have to listen to part one. It's really, it's like...
You have to. It's fire.
It's fire. So good. And we're teaching you so much and we're also laughing a lot. So please listen. And then in the second half now, you're going to hear from Bethany Kahn. She's the Director of Communications and Digital Strategy for the Culinary Workers Union, which are like the most powerful union in the state. And we get into real interesting issues around labor and political power and like transactional power
right.
from people of color and their votes and the union in Nevada.
Right. And I know you dropped down some serious comments there, but I also want to plug our bonus episode where we have a mariachi performance from the live event. It's so good, y'all. So please don't miss that.
So the interesting thing, of course, is that we're talking about Nevada and on the podcast, even though we're here in Mississippi, because what's happening in Nevada is like, okay, so there's going to be this caucus that's happening all day Saturday. There's been some, you know, early voting, but it's going to be, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. Right, Julio?
Right. And one thing important to note about the Culinary Union, since we recorded the live show, the union did come out with their statement saying who they were endorsing.
And
the endorsement is...
Turned out to be...
Nobody.
No one.
So...
And they had... You know, they did... The only candidate that they did mention was Biden.
Right.
Which is why it's very interesting in terms of...
Just the head of, like, one of the leaders of the union, who's Latina, who's an immigrant...
Yes.
Did mention that Biden was a friend, but... But
they're just like, don't write Biden off,
exactly.
Which I think is super interesting. But
the Tuesday thing.
Oh, my God.
And we
Amy.
Actually, what's funny
I,
about there
I
was a
Amy.
Forum.
I
know.
I Amy.
There was a forum on Tuesday where the presidential candidates were talking about their healthcare platforms. And we were actually in Jackson after we did our Jackson show. I think it was a dinner with everyone post show. And we all looked at our Twitter feed and we saw that Amy Klobuchar, there's a video of Amy Klobuchar. She started her speech by saying, when I was in fourth grade Spanish, they gave me the name Elena. So yeah, the struggle. And this is after she couldn't recognize who the president of Mexico was.
Yikes.
So the struggle for Amy Klobuchar and Latino voters in Nevada is real.
The struggle
it's
is real. Right.
But it's important to know as our breakfast is coming that...
So hungry.
Bernie Sanders is still leading in Nevada, and he has a big lead nationally. And there was a Washington Post ABC News poll that just came out. He is the front runner of the Democratic presidential race.
Yes, but. And the but is that because you have so many of the moderates, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, kind of splitting the moderate vote.
Yeah.
Then there's no place to him but go up. Also, don't write off Elizabeth Warren.
I'm not. Here's the thing.
By the way, please listen to Latino USA, where I got an interview
right.
with Elizabeth Warren. Finally.
Yeah, that's important you say that. I mean, one of the things that people need to know about all this is that we're just reporting what the polls are saying. And everyone's like, hey, you forgot this candidate. Hey, you forgot this candidate. We get it. It's going to happen on Saturday. The other thing is, you guys need to know that there was a debate on Wednesday night. There was a Democratic debate. We hope you're all following in the thick on Twitter because, you know, that if you were following it, we did our hot takes. I did my power rankings. They were out there and our team did some live tweeting. But just don't worry about all that, because when we come back and we're back in the studio in between our live shows next week, we're actually going to be covering next week's debate, which is in South Carolina. So don't stop, won't stop, people.
Right. Now, also, of course, one thing that we have to mention, which everybody will know now, is that Mike Bloomberg actually will be on stage. So, you know, we'll see about that. There's a lot of issues coming up for Mr. Mike.
Mr. Mike,
he's going to have to respond to things. And it's, I mean, obviously his team knew that this was going to happen. So that we're watching that closely. You guys, also, be sure to watch Julio on MSNBC on Saturday morning. Hey, yo. That's big. That's big. So you'll be able to see.
You're expected to be on MSNBC, too. All of a sudden, I will say this about the cable networks. They woke up. They're like, hey, there are Latino voters. Oh, and they're actually journalists.
Latino
have been talking about this for a while.
Exactly.
And they've been doing it. So I do have to give props.
You people can see what you look like.
There might be some. I might have to go back to the fountain for Nicole and you and do a little Ocean's 11 singing. Everyone's been fascinated by my Billy Ocean take, Caribbean Queen, in the previous Las Vegas intro. So I might do it again.
Then. Oh, my God. Back to
Las Vegas. But listen, you know that the DNC changed.
Nevada.
Speaking about the DNC.
Well, that's what we're saying. They let Mike Bloomberg
change their rules.
So that's going to happen. It's going to impact the race. Whatever we think about Bloomberg. I don't like saying this. I've been thinking about this a lot. It doesn't really matter at this point. He's in it. And what his people say is that when this guy gets in it, he's in it. And so it doesn't bring me any joy. I am beginning to feel like some fear is coming up because I'm like, what does this really mean?
Right.
And
being in Mississippi, we've talked to people in Mississippi because he has an office in Mississippi.
He's the only candidate except for Elizabeth Warren.
He has 22 people. We talked about it.
She's got two or three, so a big difference there.
But it's very interesting, even here in Mississippi where they're like, Bloomberg, it's like, hey, the guy's playing in the game. He's not going to go away. And there is going to be a lot of scrutiny about Bloomberg, not only for his past policies or his campaign, but all the fact that Bloomberg News, how do you cover a candidate who is in charge of a company that's a media company.
It's really
already raising ethical issues. And President Trump is doing all these rallies as well, these counter rallies,
He's pardoning all these people. Let's see. What are they guilty of?
Corruption.
Okay, gotcha.
And Bernie Carrick.
Bernie Carrick, please.
Who's a former police commissioner.
Any New Yorker knows we will never forgive him for what
he
did.
Guilty of tax fraud and lying investigators.
No, what he did right after 9/11. Yes. I'm not going to go into it.
Hey, and you know what Trump said? He announced on Tuesday that he was the chief law enforcement officer in the country.
So I guess
that is a quote from the president.
My fear is it's real. It's, let's just say, but al mismo tiempo, no. And what we've learned from Mississippi is what? You don't stop. When shit gets complicated here, as it is every single day, they become more creative.
I know.
And they've never gone away. And this is a cradle of the civil rights struggle.
That's right. Amazing. Here.
And we all of us who live in the United States, owe a debt to the state of Mississippi. Yeah. So sadly, they don't really have good hotel lobby music. We wish it was better. My oatmeal is over there. I really need to eat right now.
Yeah.
And we send you so much love, you guys. So take a listen to part two, live in Nevada. And enjoy.
Uno, dos, tres.
So we want to do something really special, which is to bring on stage our third super dope guest this evening. So joining us is Bethany Kahn. She's Director of Communications and Digital Strategy and a spokeswoman for the Culinary Workers Union Local 226. Welcome, Bethany.
Oh, look at that fist bump.
I'm ready.
So, Bethany, you're the daughter of immigrants.
Yes.
You're a prominent organizer for labor rights and social justice here in Nevada. You are originally from Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Yes.
Super cool Midwest, as a Chicagoan myself. So tell us a little bit about your own personal story, and how is it that you become engaged with workers' rights? So give us the Bethany bio, the short version.
So I am the first generation daughter of immigrants. My parents came to this country and they were undocumented.
From where?
From Guyana. It's in South America. So I'm kind of part of the Latinx diaspora, but I'm West Indian, South Indian.
I almost married a man from Guyana. Okay, that's it.
That was another podcast.
That's a good story.
All right.
That's another
moving
podcast.
On.
Maria's other people she might have married by Futuro Media. All right, continue.
Chapter one.
Yeah, so, I think...
No, it was more like chapter seven.
Sorry, Bethany.
That's okay.
Come on in.
So, just growing up as a daughter of immigrants who are undocumented, we never talked about immigration. You couldn't be that brave. You had to be really quiet. And we, my sister and I, and my six brothers and I, my sister, we didn't talk about immigration. You had to live in the shadows and be silent. And so yeah. I'm so proud of all of the work that right immigrants are doing now, because we just didn't have that kind of community growing up. And as my mom was a non-union food server, I saw the challenges of, you know, what it really means. So my father was a union member, and my mom was a non-union. And I could see that in the one household, the difference between having a pension and great insurance and job security and then nothing and being able to be fired for no reason. So I think when I grew up with this lens that if something's important to you, it should be written down. And a union is where you can make that possible, have a job security.
Wow. First of all, thank you for sharing that story because it's great. So just to break it down a little bit, a couple of things about this state's workforce. 15% of the workforce are part of unions, which is, by the way, one of the highest in the country, which I'm like, 15%? Wow.
It's high.
So obviously labor rights are critical here. The Culinary Workers Union, it's a powerhouse. I mean, let's be honest. And, you know, it allows tourism, service industries to survive. It's what makes this union even more significant. And I think it's another untold story is that it's powered by people of color.
Yes.
Especially Latinos, women, immigrants. They make up a significant portion of there's 60,000 members in Las Vegas and Reno alone. Many who work on the strip, 60,000. And basically like, It's POC that are kind of saving unions, right, Maria? Like,
so, everybody is waiting for your endorsement. I mean, that is true. The Culinary Workers Union.
It's not going to happen tonight.
She just started, it's not going to happen on your show. It's not happening.
Sorry.
But she's like a journalist. Like Maria's like, I'm going to ask.
Anyway, because it's a really big deal.
Yes.
I mean, what you guys have done is that really, like, you helped turn out massive amounts of voters for the 2018 midterms.
Right.
And you guys actually, you registered 10,000 new voters. You knocked on 200,000 doors.
In 2018, yeah.
So how is it that we can have this level of kind of labor engagement, this kind of activism, and at the same time, a state like Nevada being kind of overlooked?
Well, so I think that Nevada is so beautiful because it represents what I think America is going to look like in the future. And so the Culinary Union is 54% Latinx, but also 10% Black, 15% Asian, and AAPI, right? So as the fastest growing population, the Asian community here is rising. And, I always try to remember that immigration is not just a Latinx issue, it's an African issue, an Asian,
yeah.
Right? And so it's like, and I know as a young activist and organizer that like the work that I'm doing comes, right? There's so many Black women and Indigenous women who come before me to do it. And so Astrid and I are now continuing what we can, right? Moving the ball forward. But I think the Culinary Union is a great organization because we bring people together. We organize. We don't just do it during electoral cycles. We organize every day. People are used to seeing red shirts. We had that color first before Trump. And people are used to seeing our red shirts in the neighborhoods. We say defeat Trump.
Those are happy red hats.
We're committed to doing that in 2020. We're committed to defeating Trump and making sure that our country has elected officials who will fight for our families.
So talk to me a little bit about labor in the context of this cycle. Obviously, Democrats are all over the place, from the moderate Bidens to the, should I say socialists or progressives? I mean, because the word socialism should just be said. People should not be afraid of saying it because it's going to be said. You're going to hear the word socialism probably about 8 million times for the next 8-9 months. So, but there's a spectrum. There's a left and a moderate.
I think millennials we don't care about being red-baited.
Exactly. But
like
I'm just letting it out. So my thing is, when it comes to certain issues for example, like healthcare, it's safe to say, Biden and Buttigieg are kind of a little bit, it's not Medicare for all. The union, Sanders is definitely, and Warren's like, yeah, Medicare for all. Does the union grapple with that issue? Or is that something you guys talk about, healthcare and like what it means? And what are the members saying? Because it feels like it's too simplistic to me to just say like, oh, unions are for Obamacare, so we're good. But it's not that simple, is it?
No, it's kind of complicated. I mean, so the Culinary Union with our families, about 135,000 Nevadans, right? And that is the largest purchaser of healthcare in the state of Nevada. So we lead on healthcare policy. And for us, we believe in healthcare for all. We believe that we've been fighting for 85 years to have good family healthcare, and we fought to not give it up to the boss. And so we're just saying, why would we give it up to a politician?
Right.
We have a vision for what working people want, and we have enacted that here in Nevada in 85 years.
So let me
get
this straight. So basically what you're saying is, if you say Medicare for all, we understand that, but you can't disrespect the fact that in the state of Nevada, there has been a long-term union-based battle to get the best healthcare rights possible for our workers who are working 24 hours, many in these casinos where people come, you know, just to have a great time. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, it's healthcare that's been built by workers. It's run by workers. It's not for profit. And as we fight, right, as politicians fight for a vision for what working people want, it's like, hello, we have that. Come talk to us. Right. And so that's why we're saying we believe in healthcare for all. There's no reason why in the richest country in the world that healthcare is not a right. It should be. Right. And we remain committed to fight for that.
So the power of the labor movement in electoral politics, is it being underestimated? Or are we looking at a new wave of this? At least, Ruben, like, what do you think? Have you been following it, or like compared to previous Democratic elections? I mean,
it comes and goes. Right. If you take a long term. You look at where unions were much stronger in America. Unions themselves will say they were much stronger in the 1950s and 60s, and less so after the 80s. It became a new challenge for a new generation of workers to come along and organizers to bring in new union members. There are states that are more union, you know, friendly than others. So it varies. I'm struck by the fact that in 2012, you may remember this, but in 2012, Richard Trunka, who was the head of the AFL-CIO and probably still is, was so upset at being taken for granted, the union's labor being taken for granted by the Democratic Party, that he basically said we weren't going to give any money to the convention. What he was saying is what we all struggle with. If unions are 90% for Democrats, that sounds good, but unions don't want to be taken for granted by Democrats. And they have at various times had to assert themselves and say, look, we've given you a lot of money. And all we want is for you not to take us for granted because you're busy, again, what did I say before? Courting white voters in the Rust Belt states. So what I would hope for Latinos is that they learn from unions in that regard to say that nobody should be taken for granted, not Latinos and not union members. So it does, Julio, to your question, kind of come and go. If you were to charting out over the last 50 years or so, you'd see there were times where the union membership was really aggressive, times where it was lax, times where it dropped off, times where it ramped up again. And I will say this about Nevada. God bless Nevada for a couple of reasons, but one is here you can actually have a somewhat cooperative relationship between Latinos and unions, okay? But when I go speak in Michigan, Wisconsin, you know, I'll have people stand up in the back of the road and say, I'm a Democrat, been Democrat my whole life, I'm a union member, everybody in my family is a union member. I would never vote Republican because Republicans are anti-poor people. Then they'll say, now when are we going to get rid of these Mexicans? They will say that, okay? Happened to me in Madison, Wisconsin. I'll go to these places, and I'm going to tell you that when you go to the Rust Belt states and you're dealing with electricians' unions, when you're dealing with the trades, those are mostly white unions, and those unions are not pro-immigrant. So God bless Nevada, because it's not Wisconsin.
So let me ask you this, though, Astrid. I know that you want to come at Ruben. I know that you're just... but let me ask you this. I feel in my several hours of being here, and talking politics with people, I kind of feel like what Nevada has, it understands the political game, if you will.
Yeah.
Understands, no. We're not going to just give you the endorsement. You're going to have to work for it. That's what I see in Nevada.
Good. And that's being undertold. And that's being underreported because there's a lot more.
I see that this is a state that understands the push and pull because it used to be a red state. Right. So it's understood how, like today, earlier in the morning, I was speaking to a longtime Latino academic who was saying the fact that we have a lot of Latinos engaged in political process in, you know, representing the senator, for example, it's like that's not by chance. It's because there has been a concerted effort by Latino and Latina activists over the last 50 years to make sure that young Latinos and Latinas are getting educated, that they're graduating, that they are becoming engaged. Sí o no?
Claro que sí. And it, as Bethany said, it's not just Latinos. It's any other group, whatever it may be, people here are engaged. People have access. Access, I think, is the most important thing that we have.
Yeah.
We have people at any level of our government that are available to us to go and ask a question. I was baffled when I talked to Dreamers back during the 2010 Dream Act fight. And I was like, oh, just call the chief of staff from the senator's office. And they're like, what? And I'm like, yeah, no, just call them. Like, just call them.
Give them a ring.
And they're like, we can't do that. Yeah. That's like a 3-month appointment for his secretary.
Right.
That's not Nevada. In Nevada, we have access. In Nevada, I can run into my assembly person at the grocery store. I can talk to them on their Facebook. I can send them.
Why do I think you've had run into your assembly person? All the time.
I'm being district. We use the same grocery store. It's the reality. And I think that because they are embedded in our community, and let alone embedded in our community, they are from our communities.
Yeah.
And we are putting them in those positions so then they can go forth and talk, you know, go to the legislature or whatever. But other states are not like that. And I can say that. I can speak for Nevada. I can't speak for Wisconsin or I can't speak for other states. You know, I can talk crap about the caucus in other states, but I talk crap about it here too. Like, you have to understand that here we have that amazing contact where if we have a family that's in deportation proceedings, we talk to the senator's office, we talk to whoever we need to speak to, and that's very different, but it also makes it so that our community knows that for me, 11 years ago, Senator Reed helped me, and there I am still helping him. There is a family right now who I'm sure one of Senator Cortez Masto or Senator Rosen helped, and in 10 years, they will be there because they felt helped. And that, I don't feel, is happening anywhere else.
Yeah.
And so, that makes a difference in Nevada.
But Maria's point's very important, if I may really quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
Her point's very, very important about Nevada being a purple state. And it is. There's just so much going on politically here. It's because it's in the West, you can have Republicans like Brian Sandoval. When he was governor, he had no trouble standing up to the anti-immigrant rap coming out of Republicans in Washington because he's out in the West and Westerners are independent thinkers to begin with. But to your point about being in a purple state, when I was in Texas for those 5 years at the Dallas Morning News, that was very much a purple state. Latinos were paid attention to in Texas. Now I live in California, my home state of California. I've lived there now for 15 years, okay? It's a dark blue state. Democrats don't need any help to do anything in California. They don't need a single Republican vote, and they don't need Latino support anymore because Latinos have no place to go. The GOP in California is disintegrated, right? I thought when I moved to California, this was going to translate into a better situation for Latinos. Not so. Latinos in California can't get their calls returned from the Democratic Party because they are taken for granted. So what Nevada has going for it, like Texas, is that purple dimension that Maria was talking about.
So
it's on the bubble. You want to be on the bubble. You don't want to be in the tank.
Own your power.
Yeah.
I think that's your power.
I do. I think it's also one of the biggest underreported stories. I think it's eye-opening, and I think people that are listening to this should know that this state is pretty damn dynamic.
So the last question is, so historically, Nevada has been pushed to the shadows. We've been talking about that by the candidates and the media and the national parties. So tell us your pitch. Why is this a mistake, and why does the Silver State matter, and what can the rest of the country learn from Nevada's organizers and its primary season?
Bethany, you
want to.
Let's go, Bethany.
I kind of gave it away already, right?
Go.
So I think that real investment means doing the work every day. You can't just come in and out of Nevada, right? We're from the West. We know carpetbaggers. We can't just come in and out of the state and then be gone once your campaign is done or whatever, right? So real change means you have to do the work every day. And you can't just do it tied to political cycles because politicians aren't going to save us, right? It's just one piece of a comprehensive puzzle when we fight for working people. So just think about it, you know. Think about it like that.
Nice.
I think the reason we pay attention to Nevada is because it is in the West. And the significance of having, for instance, in New Mexico, when Susana Martinez was there, when Sandoval was here in Nevada, you have in the Western states, which are not Pacific states, they're not on the coast, but they're not in the Midwest either, and they're not Texas. In that sliver of Western states, independent thinkers, they are not afraid to go their own way. They don't take their orders from Washington. That's a good thing. And that is that we have seen that in real time. If you paid attention and you see how it is that Republicans in Nevada can stand up for immigrants and they don't give a damn what Republicans in Washington are doing or saying, Okay? That's an important facet to the state.
Astrid, take us home.
It comes down to, for us, like, as Bethany said, the carpetbaggers, I call them parachuters. They just come in, drop in, mess up everybody's relationships, and then they're out of here the next week. That's not, you know, we've learned to just smile and you're going to lunch with them and that's it, and then they're gone. That's fine. Our power is within our community. Our power is within the culinary union. Our power is within immigrant organizing. Our power is every single place where our communities are at. You just watched Mariachi de Plata, which was a mariachi at a college campus that has now won all kinds of awards. That would not have happened 20, 30 years ago. And that's happened because our community matters and because people are realizing, not realizing, we're making them realize that they matter.
But hold on, you need to make that connection because it's like mariachi, KKK. There was a political connect. The reason why the mariachi classes exist is because...
Senator Reed. I feel like I've mentioned him too much, but it's the reality.
Senator Reed had something to do with the fact that they have mariachi classes?
In 2002, with Javier Trujillo, they began the mariachi program at J.D. Smith Middle School. And right now, we now have 6,100 students throughout Clark County because that program was started in 2002 and then moved forward. But because, if you remember, in 2010... when Senator Reed was running and Sharon Angle said, Harry Reid is an illegal's best friend. I was that best friend. And he stood up for me. And he stood up and he said, we're going to bring the DREAM Act to the vote. You know what? It sucked because it didn't go anywhere. But it happened and it made it so that the out election was the highest turnout of Latino voters we would ever had. And so we continue that by organizing. It may not be Senator Reed anymore, but we've continued to make sure that our politicians are held accountable, whether it be nicely, whether it be meanly, whether anybody disagrees or agrees on how the tactics are. But every single one of those people are being held accountable. And that's what matters. And that's why every single person in this room matters, every single person who caucuses matters, every single person who's supporting whoever their candidate may be, because at the end of the day, Nevada will always be Nevada. Nevada has been at the forefront for our Latino community. And you know what? We're going to make sure that we don't fall into a place of, you know, 20 years from now, it's just like, oh, whatever, they're going to vote Democrat. No, you're going to vote for whoever cares about our families as much as we care about them.
Uno, dos, tres.
That's a wrap. Thank you so much to our Live in the Thick audience at the College of Southern Nevada in Las Vegas.
We also want to give thanks to those who helped plan this live show. Special thanks to Philip Turco, who is the tech master and coordinator at TSN's Performing Arts Theater, and his team. And thank you to John Jacobson, who engineered tonight's recording with the support of his sound team. And a shout out to our ITT team, Nicole Rothwell, who produced tonight's show, and to Noor and Carla for their fact-checking. And big thanks to the Kenny Quinn Center for Policy Priorities and Nancy Broon, my classmate, the executive director there, who made this live show possible through their support.
So, we want to say, give a big round of applause to our guest, Astrid Silva, director of Dream Big Nevada, Ruben Navarrete, nationally syndicated columnist, Bethany Kahn, director of communications, digital strategy, and Colony Workers Union, Local 226. Thank you so much for joining Julio and me on this episode of In the Thick. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Remember, go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us. It really helps. Remember to listen to In the Thick on Pandora and Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell your friends. In the Thick is produced by Nicole Rothwell and Noor Saudi. Our audio engineers are Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, and Leah Shaw. Our digital editor is Ms. Luna. Our intern is Carla Arroyo. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional Kept and ZZK Records.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Vegas.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.